This episode of From Angel to Exit is brought to you by Align 5. Align 5 specializes in mergers and acquisitions for growth-focused entrepreneurs and family businesses. With decades of buy and sell side experience, they prioritize client alignment, avoiding conflicts of interest common in other firms. Align 5 delivers above-average industry results by customizing strategies for diverse industries, ensuring optimal valuations, and securing strategic acquisitions or exit partners. If you want to find out more, check out align5.com. That's align5.com. Are you serious about planning a successful business exit? From Angel to Exit is your go-to resource. Subscribe to our newsletter at eckfeldt.com/podcast for even more valuable insights. And to get personalized guidance, take our free exit readiness assessment. It's just 24 questions, and it will give you a clear picture of your exit readiness. Find the assessment at eckfeldt.com/exit. Submit your results, and we'll schedule a free follow-up call to discuss your specific situation and the best way to maximize your valuation and ensure a successful transaction. Now, back to the episode. Welcome, everyone. This is From Angel to Exit. I'm Bruce Eckfeldt. I'm your host. Our guest today, Chad Williams. He is a partner at Lamb Meckerlane, and we're going to find out a little bit more about his background, what he does as a lawyer, particularly a deal lawyer, and what that process looks like. Hopefully hear some stories of some of the deals he's been in and some of the learnings he has had that he can share with us and hopefully with some of the audience on what this process looks like, what you can do to prepare for it, things that you can't prepare but you should be aware of, and how to navigate the process. So with all that, Chad, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. So before we kind of get into all the lawyer-y stuff that that you do, little background. I guess how did when did you know you were going to become a lawyer? How did this how did you get into the field? Was this something you knew you wanted to do in kindergarten? Give me a give me a sense of how you just kind of got into the space.
No, yeah, I definitely didn't think about this when I was in kindergarten or really even in high school. When I went to college, I thought I might want to be a doctor. And then by the time organic chemistry came around, I realized that that wasn't going to be a fit for me. And but I was always a pretty strong writer, communicator. And while I was in college, kind of started thinking about things that I could do. I enjoyed business generally. My dad was an entrepreneur and business owner. Mm-hmm. And so growing up, I kind of learned a lot from watching him. And so when I graduated from college, I actually worked in banking for a few years doing lending and things like that, and just learning about business from the perspective of a lender. And then kind of realized through that process that being a lawyer might give me a seat at the table that was unique and allow me to kind of use some of the, things I was naturally good at to build a career.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what, when you go into law, I guess it sounds like in your case, you were specifically looking at business law. How does kind of business law fit into the kind of general kind of world of law? You know, when we think, I think everyone just thinks of lawyers are lawyers, or at some level lawyers are lawyers. How does this differentiate? How does business law change you from other types of lawyers?
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people that I went to law school with, I think went into law school kind of thinking they would find their path within the law. I went into law school having worked in banking for a few years, and I knew that I wanted to do corporate work. And specifically, I really thought I wanted to do transactional work as opposed to litigation. So I was very focused, really from the beginning of law school on what I wanted to do. Although, I think law school was a really great experience for me just from a learning perspective, because I had to learn, a lot of different things, not just business, corporate law, but really, all of the different areas of law, and still kind of validated my decision that, I really wanted to go into doing corporate work. And fortunately, I started my career as a law clerk to the senior justice on the Delaware Supreme Court. Mm. And in Delaware, there's a lot of corporate litigation because, many corporations are either or LLCs are formed or incorporated in Delaware. And so that gave me an opportunity to see a lot of cases, see really good lawyers arguing issues that had to do with corporate, fiduciary duties, board matters, and then a lot of times transactions that were either being challenged that had already closed or that shareholders or someone were seeking to to enjoin or to stop from moving forward. So, you know, I started my career in Delaware and worked with, you know, worked on a lot of very large deals, you know, that were showing up in the Wall Street Journal. And so it was an exciting kind of way to start. But early on, after my clerkship, I worked for a firm in Delaware called Potter Anderson, which is a very well-respected firm in Delaware. And one of the firm's clients was DuPont. And we started doing, you know, we were doing deal work for DuPont on joint ventures and things that the investments that they had in other companies. Mm-hmm. And that's where I got my first taste of doing actual, you know, deal type work. Whereas kind of the traditional Delaware work was more advising boards of very large transactions, doing some of the private company work that I did for DuPont, where they were a public company, but they had invested in other companies, gave me a taste of what that work looked like. And so that's how I sort of started my path into doing deal work.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know one of the things we often talk about on the kind of the deal side is, you really want a deal lawyer as part of your transaction, not just your regular business lawyer or kind of general corporate attorney. Give us a little sense of why or what makes it different to be a deal lawyer and someone who's really familiar with these transactions, and maybe why a regular kind of business attorney who's doing, you know, non-competes or, you know, kind of more transactional or day-to-day business kind of support. How is it different or what makes you different from some of these other lawyers, and why is it important to bring someone in that actually has transaction experience into the deal?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the law has become like many other professions and businesses have become very specialized. So a lot of times, you know, maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago, you could have a lawyer that kind of dabbled in doing different things and was more of a general practitioner. But certainly over my career, I've noticed that, you know, people are either in court all of the time doing trial work, or they're more transactional lawyers. There's still, you know, lawyers who span kind of both worlds, and I certainly get involved in litigation matters, but usually from the side of trying to help negotiate a resolution and or working with litigators on those issues. But it is important because, you know, if you think about it from, you know, I'd say 90%+ of my clients are founder owners who have a private company, sometimes family businesses, but they're, you know, nearly all private companies. And when the time comes to sell the business, usually it's even for the best founder entrepreneurs, they might only have one shot at selling, you know, a company that they've built, you know, immense value in over a long period of time. And in almost every case, the parties on the other side are very sophisticated, who have done, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of deals. And so if you think about it just from that standpoint, having advisors, and not just lawyers, but accountants, M&A advisors, coaches who have been through transactions before, helps to level the playing field. And if you have someone who only dabbles in doing, you know, a sale of a company to a private equity or to a strategic buyer, while they may be a very good lawyer, they're not going to have a sense of what the some of the traps are, some of the things that you know, if you're not aware of them, you can kind of waste a lot of time or negotiate things that aren't really important and miss some of the things that are important.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, my own personal experience and having been part of a lot of these, I mean, you can spend a lot of time talking about a lot of aspects of a transaction that, you know, will certainly chew up a lot of money and may not get you, you know, the kind of the terms or the actual deal structure that is really going to serve you well going forward. So, you know, being able to parse those things seems pretty important. I guess when do you like to get involved in a transaction or in a potential transaction, and what is the early stage of that look like? Like when you first get approached, when do you like to be approached, and what is kind of on the agenda early in the process?
Yeah. So the ideal situation is where I'm familiar with the company, the owner. I've worked with them for you know, some period of time and gotten to understand the business, understand their ownership structure and kind of the things that are important to them. Yep. And I can get back to in a minute what the value of getting involved earlier is to the overall deal. But there are many times where I'm getting involved at the time where the owner has received at least one letter of intent or term sheet. And hopefully it's before he's signed it or she's signed it, but sometimes it happens.
But
typically they're non-binding except for certain provisions like confidentiality and, a exclusivity provision. But for the most part, it sets out kind of the high level terms of a prospective deal. Mm-hmm. And if I can get involved before the term sheet is signed, that's great because then we can identify some of the areas that may be issues and try to nail down as much as we can going into the diligence phase. If we can get involved, you know, even a year before the company goes to market, there's a lot we can do to really position the company and take advantage of some things, even from an estate planning perspective or tax planning perspective that might, you know, make the deal even more attractive once you get into it. But, I'd say many times I'm getting the call right at the time that the business owner is getting ready to sell. But increasingly, you know, I've got clients now that I've worked with for, you know, a decade or more, and now they're starting to think about selling. And those situations are great because there's a lot we can do in the planning process and working with other advisors to really position the company.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess walk us through. I mean, you mentioned, letter of intent and then due diligence. Like, give us a high level. I mean, and I'm sure every deal, no deal actually fits the model, but ideally, what is the kind of sequence of events that happens or phases of a transaction or a potential transaction? How do you kind of structure it, or what are the breakpoints for you in terms of what a deal goes through?
Yeah. So, you know, kind of if you think about it at a high level, you've got the LOI or term sheet phase, which is where, depending on whether the business has run a process, sometimes it might just be that they've gotten sort of a cold call and somebody that's expressed an interest, and they start to have those conversations, and then that results in an LOI or a term sheet. But that's the phase where you're kind of negotiating again, you know, generally a range of values, kind of what the material terms of a deal would be. But, you know, in almost all cases, those are non-binding. But what they do is they give the buyer the opportunity to then move to the next phase, which is the diligence phase. Mm-hmm. During that phase, the buyer is going to do financial diligence, operational diligence, and legal diligence. So the three differences there are: financial diligence is just what it sounds like. They're going to come in and do either quality of earnings or some type of financial review, going all the way down to, you know, transaction level and confirming that the numbers that were presented during that early stage are accurate and reflect kind of the financial performance of the company over a, you know, reasonable period of time. Mm-hmm. Operational diligence, they're going to come in and, you know, depending on who's going to be running the company post-closing, they're going to want to understand how the company does what it does. How do they, you know, if they're making things, how do they procure, you know, the supply, you know, their goods or what they're preparing, and then what's their manufacturing process, things like that. If it's a technology company, they're going to look at the process of developing code and how it's, you know, how the teams are set up and how they design and build and do those types of things. If it's a services company, they're going to look at the different aspects of the business and figure out how those services are delivered. They're going to look at sales process. They're going to look at, you know, really think about the process oriented, and what they're looking for is where are the areas that we can come in and make changes that will, you know, make the company more profitable or help them grow. That's an area where I think coaches, you know, particularly the companies that I worked with that have some sort of operating system and that are working with a coach are very well prepared for that aspect of diligence, because they can show a very thoughtful process into how, you know, how they've built the company. It doesn't mean that the buyer won't come in and think that there are things that they can change, but I think it positions the company very well. And then the legal diligence aspects are really looking at things like vendor contracts, intellectual property, invention assignments, organizational structure. Really, if you think of all of the legal aspects of a company, both inward and outward facing, the buyer is going to do diligence on that. Typically, when you get through, halfway through the diligence period and the buyer is comfortable that they're validating a lot of what they thought when they signed the LOI, then the lawyers will get involved and start moving towards negotiating the definitive purchase agreement. And so it's either going to be structured as an asset sale or a sale of the equity. Depending on which way you go, there are different provisions that are implicated in those types of deals. But generally, you're then negotiating the purchase agreement that will have, the material purchase terms. If it's all cash, or if it's cash plus equity, or cash plus equity and an earnout, you'll negotiate those terms. The reps and warranties, which are what mm-hmm. they sound like, basically the seller is making certain statements about the business, disclosing certain things. And then, working capital and indemnification are other big areas, and we can drill down as much as you want on that. But generally, those are the things that you're negotiating in a purchase agreement. And then you get to the end where you're really doing some ancillary documents, whether it's an employment agreement, a consulting agreement, a lease, anything that's sort of related to the transaction, but outside of the core purchase agreement. And then you get to closing and money is wired. And then depending on whether the owner is staying behind or going off to do something else, then that's kind of the next step after that.
Oh, that's great. I guess a couple questions in there just to help with the audience. So you mentioned asset versus equity sale. Give us a little sense of what those mean and which types of exits go which type of way for what reasons. Mm-hmm. Give us a little insights on that.
So, the factors that drive that decision are really generally what the buyer's preference is in terms of how they like to do the deal. And then what the seller, from a tax standpoint, how the seller views that deal. From a legal standpoint, if the buyer is acquiring the equity, they're essentially stepping into the shoes of the previous owner. So any liabilities, anything that mm-hmm. happened in the past, both positive, negative, would be essentially assumed by that buyer unless they specifically carve that out of the deal.
Got it.
In an asset deal, it's essentially you're buying whatever assets in the business that there are, and typically you're leaving liabilities behind. And there's a whole, variety of ways in each of those deals that you can make, changes within the purchase agreement that change the overall nature of that. But one reason why a party might want to buy the equity as opposed to the assets would be if there are contracts in the agreement that have assignment provisions that would require the seller to go out to all of the counterparties to those agreements and say, we want to assign to this new buyer, that can become a complicated process. It exposes the seller to risk because if those contracts don't assign, then, does the buyer still have to move forward, and it can cause disruption to those relationships. There are all sorts of factors that come in there. If the buyer is acquiring the equity and the contracts don't have a change of control provision that say, if the ownership of the company changes, then, in most cases, those contracts might not have, you might not need to let the other party know. And as long as, the company continues to perform and do what they need to do, then there's, usually no problem. But, there are a lot of, there are both business considerations as well as tax and financial considerations in terms of why you would structure one versus the other.
Yeah, helpful. So I'm curious on kind of high level deal points. Like when you first start working with a company, and say it's before you even have an LOI, they're coming to you saying, hey, look, we are going to be exiting, or we'd like to exit at some point. Like, what are the big questions that kind of come to the table in terms of the type of deal you're going to do, like the big, kind of terms that need to get kind of discussed, at least directionally, so that or at least you can advise them on how to kind of shape the deal, or what type of deal to look for, or, what to be focused on when you get into actual LOIs and due diligence and things like that.
And a great question. And that's kind of why, I really, if at all possible, would like to get involved, you know, a year in advance, because there are a lot of things that we can do, both for the individual owner or owners, as well as positioning the company for that process of going to market. But, you know, at a high level, and this is going way back, but, you know, I was always a fan of Stephen Covey, and one of the principles was begin with the end in mind. So usually if I am having a conversation with a client that's a year or more away, I'll say, think about, you know, what does a perfect deal look like? What, you know, what's the dollar amount? What are you left with after the fact? What are you doing? Do you stay on in some capacity? Do you have a plan for what you do after you sell? You know, really try to get the mental aspect of the transaction so that, you know, the owner can be very thoughtful about what that looks like. Sometimes, you know, owners will have a number in mind, but then when they run through kind of the tax and, you know, other issues with how that nets out, they look and say, wow, that number is not what I, you know, expected it to be, and that's not going to work. So doing that work at the front end to know kind of what, you know, what the numbers have to look like, because, you know, usually you're dealing with somebody who's built a great business that's producing cash flow. They're maybe running a lot of things through that. The mix between business and personal, you know, starts to get blurred. And then all of a sudden they wake up and they've sold their company, and now they don't have any of the infrastructure that they once had. They might have an assistant who is helping with a lot of things. They might, you know, have all of their emails in one place. So there are a lot of things that aren't necessarily part of the legal part of the deal, but there's things that people have to think about.
Yeah.
So doing that work up front is important. In terms of preparing the company, one of the things that I like to do is work with clients on building out a diligence data room so that when they're ready to go, you know, 80 to 90% of what any buyer is going to ask for has already been organized, put in a data room. And what it does is, number one, it sends a message to the buyer that, hey, we've been very deliberate about this. We're prepared. We're on top of our game. But number two, it provides fewer distractions to the team when you go to sell, because, you know, a sale process, if you're going out and shopping the company and then negotiating to a close, that could be a 12, 14 month process. The actual part where you're negotiating the deal is, you know, maybe 90 days, but there's a lot that goes into it. And so you want to be as prepared as you can. And then, as I said, the last thing is thinking about kind of what are you going to do after this is done? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the money is great, but if you don't have a plan and something that, you know, most entrepreneurs are type A people who are really out there. They're very creative, but they're also used to having a goal and something that they're working toward. And, you know, I've met a lot of successful entrepreneurs that have sold a company, and, you know, you talk to them 6 months, a year after they've sold, and, you know, they're itching to find kind of the next thing to work on. So if you can have that mindset going into it, I think it's important. And I think it's also important to have a walk away, because once you get into negotiating a deal, there are buyers out there that, whether they find something in diligence or the market shifts while you're in the process, and then they start to whittle away at what you thought was, you know, this number, then it becomes something different. And sometimes, you know, the seller gets into a situation where they just want to get the deal done. And I think going into a process, you kind of have to know, these are my non-negotiables. And if they start to change, I'm going to shut it down and kind of regroup and do something different.
Yeah. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I've certainly seen that happen. What do you need to do to kind of maintain that ability to walk away? Because I certainly see situations where people get so caught up in the process, and they're so invested, you know, they put so much time and energy into a potential deal, and, you know, in some cases I've seen, you know, businesses start to deteriorate a little bit, right? They take their eye off the ball, and now they're kind of, ugh, like, I'm going to stop this process. I've got to go back and kind of clean up the company. Like, it can be pretty dramatic sometimes. What do you advise, or what do you see, you know, good sellers do to kind of maintain the power of being able to walk away from the deal if the terms start going in a way that is unacceptable?
Yeah. Well, I think first it's kind of being honest about what's driving the decision to sell in the first place, because if you're burnt out and you're, you know, you just have gotten to a point where you're ready to move on to something different.
Mm-hmm.
That may be very different than someone who loves what they're doing. They can see the next 10 years of growth, but they're presented with a great opportunity to maybe, you know, sell 80% of the company, hold on to 20% and, mm-hmm. and take de-risk, you know, because a lot of times an owner will have the vast majority of their net worth tied up in the value of their business. So really it's being honest and being clear about what's driving the transaction. And then communicating with all of the members of the deal team, your advisors, your senior executives, whoever else is involved, that look, these are the things that we must get out of this deal. These are the things that are nice to have. And as long as our must-haves don't, you know, start getting whittled away, we can negotiate on the fringes on some of these other things. But having sort of that core list of things that if a seller, if a buyer starts to push back on things that they've, you know, that are material deal points, that you just say, no, we won't do that, and be willing to kind of stand behind that. So if you say no, you don't want to play games where, well, I'm going to say no, and then, you know, if they won't give in on this point, I'll go back and negotiate. Because once you do that, you've really lost sort of any leverage that you have. So
yeah.
I think it's being very clear about what, you know, what the objectives are and not, you know, deviating from that if you can avoid it.
Yeah. I know I've seen some pretty complicated deal terms, and I'd be curious to kind of get your take on how you kind of advise around some of these things. Because I've seen, you know, there's kind of cash, you know, cash at sale components. There is deferred payout, right? So it's just it's a note or some kind of fixed payment, you know, sometimes collateralized, sometimes not. There is earnout, which is, you know, based on, you know, company performance. And then I've seen executive agreements where founders stay on and there's, you know, additional money to be made, but more as their role is ongoing, you know, CEO or being part of the executive team or something. And so there's kind of lots of ways you can kind of make money on a deal, but they all have kind of different hair and kind of complexities. And I've seen a lot of situations where, you know, the number looks great, but because the number is sliced up in all these different ways, right, it requires people to stay on and then they haven't really thought through what that means. And they're 6 months post transaction and they're like, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. But now they're stuck because they, you know, they kind of have to stay on to earn the rest of the money. Like, how do you help founders kind of think through sort of where those different options and what the consequences or what's the kind of the nuance of those options in terms of really kind of understanding what the valuation is or how the valuation is going to get paid out?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, the first thing I always advise is if the only money that the seller got out of the deal was the cash at closing, would they still do the deal? Because all of those other aspects, there's some, to varying degrees, some level of risk. So as you said, you know, the cash at closing is what it sounds like. It's the yeah. money that gets wired to your account the day that you sign the paper and you close. Yeah. Everything else really builds value on top of that. So if there's deferred consideration where it's literally just, as you said, like a note or, you know, timing based payments, you want to try and get those as locked up as you can. So if you're selling the equity, you might get a pledge of that equity back so that if there's a default, you would take some of the equity back. Or if it's a, you know, large enough seller, you might be confident that they've got the ability to back it up, but you might look for a guarantee from a parent entity or something like that. That's, although it's, you know, it's paid out over time, those are typically fairly secure.
Yeah.
Everything that you get from that point forward then has even more risk. So earnouts, there's a judge in Delaware years ago, I remember reading this in a opinion about an earnout dispute, and he referred to earnouts as full employment for lawyers, and meaning that, you know, basically if you have an earnout in your deal, there's a very good chance that there's going to be some dispute. And yeah. the types of things that come up in that is designing earnouts usually involves the future performance of the business based on variables that are unknown.
Yeah.
So, you know, for example, if you're selling the company, but you're not going to stay on, you're now relying on whoever is buying to actually perform in a certain way that will produce, you know, the outcome that you're looking for.
Yeah.
And even if, you know, key employees are staying on and things like that, ultimately someone else is going to be making a decision, and they may not make the decision that is the best decision to maximize a short-term earnout, but it might be the right decision for sort of a long-term growth of the company. And so whenever you have an earnout, you're always negotiating around those things. And if I'm representing the seller, I'm saying, look, we want them to guarantee that they're going to continue to run the business the way that you run it today. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, that you're not going to take the, you know, the heat, or that you're not going to, you know, have the detriment if they don't do that.
Yeah.
Very rarely will buyers agree to, you know, that type of provision. And so you have to negotiate some guardrails around what they will and won't do. But, you know, I've had cases where we've gone into the deal, we know that that's going to be an issue. And when it does become an issue, at least you've got some in the agreement, some sort of mechanism to, you know, contest certain things, dispute and try to resolve it in good faith.
Yeah.
A lot of times as well, you know, you'll have owners that get equity in a deal. So they'll roll over equity and they'll have some interest in the future performance of the company. You want to make sure that that equity doesn't get diluted or so far behind, you know, the rest of the equity that it's really valueless. And then if the owners are staying on in some capacity, whether it's a formal employment role or consulting role, you want to be clear about what the terms of that are. Sometimes if it's just in a short-term transition, maybe 60, 90 days, there won't be additional payment for that. And the buyer's expectation is that the sellers will be available as needed to help answer questions, kind of make a smooth transition. If it's longer than that, then a lot of times you want to negotiate the right compensation arrangements. If there's if there are options or additional equity that the individual can earn, you want to negotiate those things. So, your question's great, because that's where there are a lot of ways that you can increase value. And if you're really trying to maximize and get a premium valuation, you might get, you know, the cash portion sort of locked up, and then for everything sort of above what that bottom line number is, you can really try to create incentives. And negotiating those are great too, because in the perfect situation, the buyer will love paying that out, because it means that the business is performing and that there's a, you know, so you really want to try to align incentives when you're negotiating those aspects of the deal.
Yeah. I've been involved in a couple of deals where, founders are going off and doing other things and retaining, you know, IP or even potential clients or something, you know, non-competitive clients or, you know, having non-competes of various sorts. Like, how do you kind of think through some of the non-financial deal terms that may affect kind of the value of the deal for the seller that, you know, the buyer may be fine with it, and it may actually increase the value for the seller, knowing that, oh, okay, I can go off and, you know, take this IP into a non-competitive market, or maybe I can take some of the clients that is not core and provide the other services. Like, how do you kind of think through or find opportunities around that part of the deal?
Yeah. So, you know, if there's intellectual property or business interest that is tangential and completely unrelated, usually buyers are not going to care a whole lot, except that they'll want you to disclose it, sort of explain what it is, and get some sort of comfort level that it's truly not competitive, not leveraging any assets of the business that they're requiring or that they're acquiring. It gets, you know, but as you can imagine, from a buyer's perspective, they want to know that they're not buying a business and then basically having funding their competitor right out of the gate.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, if it's even, you know, selling to the same customer or, you know, involving people that worked for the business that's being sold, but that might have, you know, knowledge and something to contribute, the buyer may start to ask, you know, some more questions and things. So the earlier on in the process that a seller could say, hey, this is what I plan to do after I sell the company, I don't think it's related, but have that conversation, I think you can avoid sort of the 11th hour issues that come down the road.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you said, a lot of times, especially if the seller is sort of cashing out and they're not going to be involved in the business going forward, the buyer is going to ask for a non-compete. And while non-competes, you know, generally are now the enforceability of those provisions when it comes to employees, is, you know, the courts are more reluctant to enforce, you know, a non-compete on an employee, whereas non-solicitation, trade secrets, you know, intellectual property assignments are generally more, you know, viewed as enforceable even against employees. When it comes to someone who's selling their business, courts are not only going to enforce, you know, non-solicitation, trade secrets, that type of thing, but they'll also enforce a non-compete. And so what you want to do there is negotiate a couple of things. One, if there's a default on any contingent payment, whether it's deferred consideration, earnout, equity, anything like that, that the seller could be released from the non-compete so that, you know, if they're not getting the full benefit of their bargain, they have the ability to go out and do that. So that provides a check on a buyer that, you know, might otherwise, you know, violate some term in the agreement. And then absent that, you want to try and tailor kind of the geographic scope. So is it, you know, nationwide? Is it only within a particular region that you can't compete, that type of thing? And then the duration, you know, how long is that going to last? And I think sort of the, even in the sale of a business, unless there are unique circumstances, the kind of longest term that you typically see in market is maybe 5 years, but it could be anywhere between 2 to 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an important one. Kind of similarly, reps and warranties has come up a couple of times with a few deals where, you know, those can be, you know, if not, you know, meaningful, at least worrisome from a seller point of view. And, you know, whether it's, you know, just getting those really locked up or getting some insurance or things like that around this, like how do you handle reps and warranties? That's one thing sellers don't think a lot about in terms of, okay, they're going to be on the hook or you're going to have to maintain some liability in many cases.
Yeah. So, that's another reason why if we can get involved, you know, a year or more before the deal, it's helpful because we can essentially do our own diligence on the company, look at all these things and identify potential areas of risk. But the way to think about reps and warranties is really just a balance or allocation of risk between the buyer and seller. So the buyer is going to come in, they're going to look at, and the reps and warranties will be everything from that that the company was organized on a particular date, that the owners are who we say they are, that the financial statements have been prepared in accordance with GAAP or some other, you know, accounting methodology. And then you'll make reps and warranties about things like labor and employment, about contracts, about intellectual property, about environmental risks, all those sorts of things. In that process of negotiating the agreement, if you identify specific issues in diligence, they'll be disclosed on a disclosure schedule. And what that does is it basically says, look, both parties were aware that these are the things that were out there.
Yeah.
And then it sort of, in many cases, it'll cut off a claim from the buyer down the road that they didn't know something. So to the extent you can disclose things during that negotiation process, it's important. Then you get to kind of the indemnification provisions, which say if a party has breached one of those reps or warranties, who has the liability to do that? And within that negotiation, you're going to negotiate things like a deductible, a cap on certain types of liabilities. And then the buyer will often ask for a holdback of some kind for some period of time so that if those claims come in, there's a pool of money sitting there. They don't have to go back out to the seller and try to recover.
Yeah.
One product that's come up, you know, within the last, I don't know, decade or so is rep and warranty insurance.
Yeah.
And the value that provides is instead of having to, you know, park in some cases could be a couple million dollars in an escrow or some sort of holdback, the seller gets that money. The buyer gets the assurance that if there are certain risks that there's an insurance policy that you can go, you know, you can make a claim on and recover, and you pay a premium that's, you know, usually a fraction of what you would otherwise hold back in a deal. And now, you know, you've got coverage on both sides from, you know, you've really addressed the issue from both the buyer and seller's perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious what else you'd recommend, you know, by sellers that are kind of early in the process, other things that are just good to do early that are going to make the kind of either the deal process better or kind of make you more viable or, you know, improve valuation, you know, any couple of things that you really advise companies to do sooner rather than later.
Yeah. So I, you know, a couple of things. So one, I think a lot of times owners have a network of other entrepreneurs, business owners that they know. And if you know others who have sold a company, it's good to talk to them, just get their perspective on, you know, from there, when they went through the process, what do they wish they would have done differently? What did they do that they were glad they did? You know, those get that type of feedback. I think the second thing is to build your team, you know, as far enough in advance as you can. And that's both internal and external. So internally, who are the people that you're going to rely on to respond to diligence requests, to, you know, be on the team when the buyer is, you know, the buyer is going to look at them as kind of a critical member of the team. And so you want to make sure that they have incentives to both assist in the process, that you can bring them in confidentially and let them know that it's going to happen and they're not going to take their eye off the ball. Mm-hmm. And then also maybe design some sort of incentive plan where if they get a bonus, they get part of it when the deal closes, but then they get part of it, you know, as a retention bonus where they can stay on. And that will help with the buyer because then they know that there's an incentive that's already been established.
Yeah.
Externally, you know, it's basically finding your accountant, your lawyer, if you're going to use an M&A advisor, you know, an either investment banker or someone that's going to help shop the company, doing, you know, your estate planning, if there's tax planning that you can do to minimize taxes, all of that stuff you want to do before you have an LOI, because once you've got an LOI in hand, you really limit what you can do, particularly from like the estate and tax planning, because the value has essentially been set in an arm's length negotiation. Yeah. So those are some things that you can do very early on. And then, you know, if I get involved at least a year in advance, I'll do what I said. You know, we'll do kind of our own diligence on the company. We'll build out a data room. Sometimes clients will even do a quality of earnings review so that they can identify any issues that might come up with a buyer and either address them now so that they aren't an issue when you go to sell, or at least you're aware of it so that when it comes up during diligence with the buyer, you have, you know, an answer for how you want to solve it, or you're not surprised. So really doing all that work in advance it levels the playing field, because again, you're dealing with buyers who have a lot of experience doing deals. Mm-hmm. They know, most don't want to get off on the wrong foot because they're buying your company because they think it's great and they believe that there's value there. But I've definitely seen buyers that are a little unscrupulous, where they'll put that big number out there in the LOI, knowing that once they get into diligence, they're going to find things that will allow them to whittle away at that number. Yeah. So the more the business owner can do in advance to protect against that, the more confidence they're going to have going into a process, knowing that, you know, that number is the number, and that the buyer's not going to play games sort of once you get into the negotiation process.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big fan of get everything on the table up front, right? Get all the skeletons and all the issues up front, because, you know, once you do and you've got a number, it's much less likely that you're going to get that haircut later, right? Like if you hold on to these things, hopefully they're not going to find it, or like, oh, we'll deal with that later. Right. They just become excuses for how to take 10%, 20%, 30% off these prices and stuff. So, excellent. Chad, this has been a pleasure. If people want to find out more about you, the work that you do, what's the best way to get that information?
Yeah. So, they can find me on LinkedIn, or my website, LAMB, Macerlane, MCERLANE.com. I'd be happy if people have questions about the M&A process or just want to connect, I'd be happy to talk to them.
Great. I will make sure all the notes are on there.
Great.
Chad, thanks for taking the time today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Bruce. This was great. Thanks.